Welcome to AZMCast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Happy September, everybody. We this month are taking a sharp departure from our normal programming and talking about something that is 100% medically related and almost 0% evidence-based. No, not strokes. We already did that. Not ACS. No. Not Press-Ganey scores. Good guess. No, not the Joint Commission. Worse. This month, we are talking about healthcare policy. Jared shares a bit of how this podcast came about, but essentially, this is a topic that affects every part of every day of our lives. But most of us, especially those of us on the podcast, know very little about it. So rather than pretend that we know the answers, we started basic and just defined the term so that you, the listener, can come up with the answers that we all need. And unlike most episodes where we babble incoherently, this month we have the bonus of two, count them, two peer reviewers who have diverse opinions and way more experience than we do. So as much as you may want to avoid this episode, I encourage you to listen to it to help yourself make an informed decision. And with that, it is with much trepidation that we bring you this month's AZMCast. Welcome to the very last episode.
The apocalyptic episode.
So this is actually, you guys may not know, this is our 50th episode that we have done.
Yeah. Is that silver or platinum?
I don't know. What are you going to buy me?
I don't know.
That'll be nice, though.
This is all you, man. This is a testament to your dedication.
Yeah, congrats,
Yay, Aaron.
Good job, Aaron. Thank you. So with all of that, we actually did a little bit of, we went on the Google, and we paid a little extra to see if we could run some stats, and we don't want to do this podcast anymore. We found that our podcast is downloaded 18,000 times a month. I'm sorry, accessed 18,000 times a month, downloaded over 1,500 times a month, and listened to in 49 states and 36 countries.
Screw you, South Dakota.
Yeah, come on, South Dakota. Well, that's not how we get them on board. South Dakota is the only place where we haven't done it. So, Ben Rufato, as you're doing your wild mystery van tour through North America, just stop off in South Dakota, download our podcast, and go on your merry way. We decided to get a little bit topical. We were getting a little bit timely, and Jared had the idea. Do you want to tell everybody how you pitched the idea to me?
Yeah, so healthcare policy is the hot topic right now. The Republicans want to repeal and replace Obamacare. The Democrats want to expand Medicaid and strengthen Obamacare. And at the end of 2016, Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is a trained physician, who I think was an emergency physician at Harvard, left her job to become a staff writer at the New York Times and wrote this book called An American Sickness. And it was basically an H&P on the American healthcare system and why we are where we are and what we can do about it. She's since left her job and become the editor-in-chief of the Kaiser Family Foundation. But I read her book, and at the end of it, I realized I know absolutely nothing about healthcare policy or the business of healthcare or the politics of healthcare or even healthcare infrastructure. And I know we spend a lot of time talking about it. And I think, you know, we go into medical school because we want to help people and we try to learn all this stuff about how to practice the best medicine. And we have no idea. We see a patient, you do what you need to do for that patient, and you try to be conscientious about it, and you write down on a chart or type into an electronic medical record what you did, and it goes off into Ethos, and you get a paycheck every 2 weeks. And we have no idea what we're doing to cause some of this. We have no idea what's happening on our behalf, and we have no idea healthcare delivery. Chris and I were talking about this the other day, how we need to separate whether we're talking about healthcare delivery or health insurance, and I don't think anybody on any level has been able to figure out those differences. And so I pitched the idea to Aaron that we should have a podcast about this. That I can't imagine I'm the only one that knows nothing about this, that we should have a podcast where we kind of define what these terms are without getting too political about it.
So I would say we have a diverse opinion of just politics and culture in general, but we certainly have no knowledge of this thing that we are at the epicenter of.
Yeah, one of the things that's really bothered me when you watch the news coverage of some of this stuff is there's a lot of implication that we are willingly doing this stuff. And yes, maybe there are some ophthalmologists who's doing some shady practices, but as emergency physicians, we go to work, we see our patients, we try to do the best we can, and we go home and do our hobbies and hang out with our families, right? We're not.
Yeah, no one's out there with a cardboard sign flipping it around asking people to come into the emergency department.
Exactly, but you read this article that was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about MCARE and the surprise billing, and there's this implication there that we are willingly doing this. Maybe we're being manipulated into it by administration. I honestly do not know the answer to that, but I know I'm not willingly doing it, and I know you guys aren't willing.
I'm free to admit that I may have been willingly ignorant.
Yeah.
And I got to thank Dr. Mosher for putting this, not just this idea together, but just even the framing the context and the different definitions. I wasn't even aware of what definitions I didn't know about. And Jared was able to put those together and help me educate myself over the past few weeks as we prepared for this podcast.
So Jared asked me, can we do a podcast on healthcare policy? And I said, absolutely not. He said, we could do it nonpartisan. I go, that doesn't seem to be possible, just looking at our political climate and everything right now. He said, and his argument was, do you even know what people are arguing about? And much like Chris, I said, no, I don't. He said, well, what if we just define the terms? So we decided, let's take 10 healthcare policy terms and define them.
And while you're looking that up, I mean, this has the potential to be the most boring podcast we have ever done. But if we just sit here and talk about the definitions and don't get into why they're important to talk about, which can be have a little friction to it, then this is going to be boring. And I'm okay talking about the pros and cons to these, you know. Let me put it this way. Every policy that we'll talk about, every different philosophy or method of practicing healthcare or acquiring payment for your services is not intended to be nefarious. No one comes to a politician with like their mustache twirling and saying, how can we screw over the populace and make more money? I really don't think so.
Yeah.
So what we'll talk about is what each one of these policies is intended to do, and then maybe a little bit of speculation on what the unintended consequences, negative outcomes, and unintended consequences are for these.
Yeah, and some of these we even found different definitions depending on who is defining it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to cover a couple terms. We're going to talk about the exchange or the market. We're going to talk about the charge master. We're going to define essential health benefits, cost sharing reductions, value-based pricing, fee-for-service, reinsurance, surprise billing, balance billing, and the 80-20 rule. And for those of you that just swerved off the road, we want you to come back, all right? Because, unfortunately, this matters. And that's why I couldn't talk Jared out of doing it, is it actually does matter that you know what this stuff
is. So important.
Can I give a little historical context before we dive into this?
I can't stop you.
Yeah, you can't. You have the editing power, but you can't stop me. So... So I think it was like in the 1920s in Texas when the blues started. And it, back then, if you... What?
Are we talking the blues like...
what kind of blues?
Blue Shield.
Okay, I thought, I'm like, blues were way before 1920.
And it was in New Orleans.
Blue Cross, Blue Shield.
We just and lost Louisiana.
If you recall, at the time in the 1920s, I mean, we really didn't even have anything that... What could we treat people with? We barely had sulfa as the first antibiotic, and that was mostly in Europe. We were still killing people with ethylene glycol, trying to make a soluble form of it here. So if you were sick in the 1920s, you go to the hospital, you either died or you stayed there for a few weeks. And so the Blue Cross Blue Shield was started to try to insure you against wage losses during that period of time, not to pay for healthcare because you couldn't really deliver healthcare. So after World War II, Congress enacted this law, and I don't remember the exact details, so I don't want to give you a lie here, but they made some law that turned healthcare into a health insurance into a business, and that spiraled into what we had in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, where if you had a pre-existing condition, you were uninsurable because it was all about making money for the insurance companies. If you had a lifetime cap or premiums were super high if you had anything that was high risk, if you were pregnant or had kids or whatever. And so things were out of control. We had millions of uninsured people, and this is where the healthcare conversation really started to spark. Obamacare came, and that was kind of the kindling to a fire that exploded, and that's how we got to where we are now.
So, in the creation of this, we have created a marketplace. We've created a business out of healthcare. Insurance companies are a business.
This is the basic premise behind all insurance, is it's a bet. Where one side says, I'm expecting this outcome, the other side says, I'm expecting the other outcome, and your outcome is, you're betting that you won't have, that you will have the negative outcome. That's why you're willing to put forth these premiums, because you're hoping that eventually it'll pay out to your benefit. The insurance company is really hoping that you don't get sick, so that you're paying forth these premiums. Now, this may come into question when we talk about the 80-20 rule later, but that's the basic premise behind insurance.
And the problem with that, with healthcare, is that it's not like a fire or a flood or a tornado or something that's rare. Yeah, a car crash. I mean, this, you're likely to get sick. Right. You or someone in your family is likely to get sick. And so it's really more like credit. And so how are you going to pay for it? Is the person going to pay for it? Is the government going to pay for it?
And that's where it gets real squishy, because when it first started, the whole concept of things like Social Security insurance was that you were not going to need it.
Right.
And now we're applying it to things like routine primary care, pediatric care, vaccinations, and really maybe there should be a distinction between that kind of health care and catastrophic health insurance. That and honestly, it's the catastrophic sides of it that eat up most of the costs.
Right, and most people that were insured had employer-based health insurance where they had a job with good benefits, and part of those benefits included health insurance, and it was either quote-unquote good or bad. It's not like you could really shop that around that, and so the marketplace was set up for people who wanted to get insurance outside of their employer-based insurance. So that's what the marketplace was, and how does that function?
Well, I think if you look at the marketplace, you can go online, right, and look for it, and in a sense, each state has set up their own marketplace.
Some states have.
And some have said, we don't have a marketplace, and just allow you to go to the common government-based,
right.
U.S. government-based marketplace. In a sense, it's really going online, right? Or you can call someone, but you have to enroll in a plan, and they give you options, but you have to give them a lot of information. That was the interesting thing looking at this myself, is I tried to see what my marketplace would look like. But I didn't really feel like giving my Social Security number,
right,
telephone number, and all this information
to
some website that you couldn't get past, and I didn't really want a random insurance that I didn't need or start to get questions. So
and
that
then
was,
the telemarketing calls start.
Right, and so it's a hard thing to get past, but that's what you're doing now. Now you're signing up just like you would for an email account. You're having to shop for this.
And this is, I've kind of said this before, that healthcare is a lot like taking your car to the mechanic. You only really go if something's wrong. When you go, you don't really know the right terms to use. You just know that something's not right, and you have no idea how much it's it's going to cost, how long it's going to take, but you know it's going to be expensive and that you're really not going to be able to argue with it. Unless you put in a lot of time and effort to know your car inside and out, and at that point you're probably taking better care of yourself and you only need to go see a mechanic if you're in a wreck.
Right, so these exchanges have been started, and there's been a lot of controversy over the stability of them. And you can see from the insurance standpoint, well, we can't really control if we have a mandate that anybody can sign up, and we have this mandate that everybody has to sign up, or else they get a tax penalty or whatever. Then how are we going to control what that risk is? And the way they set their premiums is based off of the general risk of the population. Chris, correct me if I'm wrong. And so there have been things to try to stabilize those markets, and in the first 3 years of the marketplace, there was reinsurance and risk corridors that were set up. So if you're an insurance company and you set up these small group policies or individual policies, and you think somebody's particularly high risk, and to keep the premium at a reasonable rate, you insure that insurance policy, and that's called reinsurance. If you're and so what happens is each company pays into a pot of money that the HHS then doles out over the first 3 years of Obamacare to try to stabilize that premium increase until the market stabilizes. Then there's risk corridors, that's one layer above the individual or group plan, that's the insurance plan insurance policy, where the insurance plans pay into a certain amount of money, and if they end up spending more, if their loss to profit ratio is negative, then the HHS will dole out that money. And those things were meant to stabilize the market. And they were a 3-year temporary program. And then in order at the individual level for for individuals to have reasonable premiums, the government set up these cost-sharing reductions where the government would then pay, I think it's like $7 billion or something, to the insurance companies to offset their loss. And that's one of the points of contention as to why things are unstable, because the Trump administration is threatening to not pay those cost-sharing reductions.
So backing up, is there a difference between an exchange and the marketplace? For the lay listener, when they say they hear about the healthcare exchange or the healthcare marketplace, is there a difference?
I don't think so.
No, there's no difference.
It seems to be the same.
Okay.
Okay, so somebody goes to the hospital and they see a doctor, they see one of us, I see you, and you do an exam on me, and you want to get some lab tests, and you get some imaging, and you do those things, and you write your note, and you send me home, and I get some bill. How is that bill determined?
There's a product called the Charge Master.
That's that thing that Neo was after in Matrix Revolutions, right? He was trying to find that guy.
No. It's like that. It's that thing in the. No, that's the gatekeeper. You're thinking. Yeah, gatekeeper. Yeah. So.
Oh, that's Zool.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
I am the Keymaster.
I am the gatekeeper.
So the Charge Master is kind of described often as a living set of data, and it's. It's nebulous. There's maybe a couple people in the entire hospital that have access to it.
Ah, the dreaded duck quack. We don't bring this one out much, but we use this audio cue to note when we're fact-checked by our peer reviewers and found to be dead wrong. In this case, one of our peer reviewers pretty much skewers us on our interpretation of the Charge Master. Namely, that we don't distinguish between cost, how much the service or product costs the hospital or the provider, charge, how much the patients and the payer are asked to pay, and reimbursement, how much is actually collected by the payer. He also notes that the Charge Master, as set by a smaller democratic group, is much more open than perhaps that of a contract medical group. Yet another great save by our peer reviewers.
And maybe one of those two people knows what it means and has maybe editing capabilities to it. But that's the form that is always in flux that determines all the costs for everything, from cleaning the room that you were in to the Band-Aid that you were given to your appendectomy to your aftercare.
And what about your cost? You do your thing as a physician, and you get reimbursed based on your level of billing, a certain amount of RVUs that are attached to that, and who determines what that is and what the rate per RVU is.
Yeah, the coders and billers, right?
Yeah.
So that means we should all know what we're charging all of our patients all the time, right? I saw it even described on one blog as it's like going to a restaurant and ordering off a menu. It's absolutely not like that. Because when I go to a McDonald's, I know what my Big Mac's going to cost, and it's somewhere between, you know, it's not somewhere between 50 cents and $50,000.
It's like going to a French restaurant where they put down
market price.
Yeah, they put down a menu in French, and there are no prices. And if you have to ask, you can't afford it.
So there's the CEO from Athena, the CEO of Athena Health. His name's Jonathan Bush. He said that the price for an MRI at one of his hospitals was $1,200. Just 2 miles away at another hospital, it was nearly $3,000. And 12 miles away, it was $700. He says all of these MRIs have the exact same machine, make, and model. Now, do you think the physicians working at those hospitals have a clue?
No.
No. So what does our MRI cost?
No idea.
I have no idea. And that really, really bothers me.
Yeah, I asked recently, can I see the charge master? And they said no.
You're not the gatekeeper.
It's apparently a law that you can't show the physicians.
So I did a little research into this because, as you'll see throughout the episode, the lack of transparency with regard to the charge master drives me absolutely crazy. Not only could I not find any state or federal law prohibiting the disclosure of a charge master, but I found that California has a law requiring the disclosure of the charge master to the general public. So if you want an idea of how much things may cost in a hospital in California, follow the link that's on the screen or go to www.oshpd.ca.gov/chargemaster. This is part of the Payer's Bill of Rights established in 2006, and it's great to see some transparency on behalf of the patients to the hospitals. However, while all states require some degree of transparency to the government, California is the only one to actually require the charge master itself be public record. And even more disconcerting is that the insurance company charges are conspicuously not required at all. Seems like a sketchy one-way street.
So on my behalf, you're billing for services that I think are necessary. Probably inflated prices. One of the things in the book that she talks about is she gives an example of every single time there's been consolidation in health systems. She gives the example of Sutter Health in Northern California. There's a consolidation of health systems, and they use their market power to drive up prices. And in the Sutter Health case, it's like 40%. So you take over a small hospital, immediately jack up the prices by 40%. And your example of the MRI, the free market enthusiasts would say, well, that $700 MRI is going to make the other ones come down, but it appears that most of the time the $700 one's going to go closer to the $3,000 one.
Yeah. And just in defense of free market, I think the problem is a lack of free market that's causing...
You don't know what you're buying.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not an open communication and contract between two participants. There is a third party involved, and you get to spend their money.
Right. So who determines the charge master?
I don't know.
I don't.
It's not the CFO. From what I can gather, the CFO just has someone else assigned to it, and they're usually a nurse.
So my understanding is the charge master is a proprietary set of information that is usually begged and bartered. They have like eBay for medical equipment and all this stuff that people sell back and forth. I mean, it's hospital-wide that you basically have to pay to know how the magic trick is done. And now you're in the guild and you've got the charge master and you can alter it based on what the need is.
Yeah, so I struggle with two things there. The defenders of a charge master would say that you inflate prices so that you can cover the uninsured people. But what seems to be happening is the uninsured cash-paying people get that full price.
Yeah.
They sometimes will get a negotiated price or whatever, but for the most part, they get that price. And then the second thing is, how are you supposed to be a conscientious consumer of healthcare when you don't even know how much stuff costs?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the charge master is the charge master, but you don't... Well, this gets into other terms that we're going to define, but in-network and out-of-network, and whether you get a negotiated charge on your bill is dependent on whether you go to somebody in your network or a facility in your network, and whether they're going to charge you up to whatever price is on the charge master, right? And that's what you're talking about.
So
right
is there any question in anyone's mind that the charge master is intentionally kept ambiguous and nebulous.
Not a bit.
Absolutely not. I was reading that a knee replacement in New York City costs $70,000, but the same exact materials and everything, if you have it done in Alabama, it costs $12,000. Well, if that was an open discussion and everyone knew it, that guess what everyone would be doing? They'd be getting in their plane and they'd be flying to Alabama for their knee replacement.
Right. Now, to be fair, you got to consider some other options, though. Of a house in Tucson, Arizona, is about a tenth of the cost of a house in San Diego, which is about a tenth of the cost of a house on the island of Manhattan, you know? So there is something about location, location, location. I want it nearby. I want the very best. And so you can say that places recruit the very best, and so you're paying for the very best, but you want to know.
You want to know.
That's why you're paying for it. I want to go to, you know, the Brigham, because that is, I guess, where the best whatever is, and so that's why I'm going, and I don't mind paying extra money for that because I know I'm at the best. That is rarely our occurrence in the emergency department, where you are brought here by an ambulance, oftentimes against your will, and you're plopped down in front of us, and now we are legally bound to evaluate you and treat you, even if you absolutely hate our hospital with a passion and can't wait to get out. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy scenario that you just can't apply normal business practices to medicine, let alone emergency medicine.
One of the things I find a little sketchy on the hospital side of things is if you're a for-profit hospital, then it is what it is, right? If you're, I think Mayo Clinic's for-profit. If you're the Mayo Clinic and you say, this is what we charge, you want to come here, this is what you're going to pay, right? And we want to make money. If you're a nonprofit hospital, the way you get your tax-exempt status is by providing a certain amount of charitable care for the community. But there is a wide open door there for you to try to fudge what charitable care means, right? At one point, you could be denying surgeries that people need because they're uninsured or expecting huge co-payments, for example. And knowing that they can't afford that, and then it's their choice not to get that surgery and those kinds of things. So one of the things she talks about at the end of the book is that we as physicians and citizens of a community should ask our hospitals, what are you doing that makes your 501c3 status appropriate? Mm-hmm. And those are publicly available tax forms to try to parse out what
are they doing. We should take back our charge master. Right. We should see what it is. Patients should see what it is. Yeah. It's in Epic. So when you with all of the different EMRs out there, that's often part of the package. So there is some module within Epic that I don't have access to and no one else here does.
The gatekeeper would.
But the gatekeeper would. That's how they manage it. It's in Epic.
There was actually a study done in JAMA Internal Medicine where they looked at about 12,000 or so different emergency docs from different hospitals and about 50,000 internal medicine doctors, and they looked at their billing that they sent to Medicare. And they looked at the difference between the same tests as done by emergency doctors versus as done by internal medicine doctors. And the markup was far more for emergency medicine. It was somewhere between, they said the markup was between 1 to 12.5 times what it was supposed to have cost according to what Medicare says. And the internal medicine ranged between 1 and 14 times what Medicare says it should have cost.
And this isn't what we charge, right? I mean, if I sew up your laceration here versus 3 miles from here at another hospital, those aren't different charges for me personally to sew up that laceration. It's what the hospital charges for that.
So this is what the bill is. This is what the charge goes out to Medicare saying, this is how much we are asking you to pay. Now, the argument for that is that one of their conclusions is that the emergency doctors consistently asked for more money to do the same test as the internal medicine doctors, which, be that as it may, I think you do get more money for being having 24-hour access, for having a different skill set within emergency medicine than in internal medicine. So there's some argument for that, but you also have to give a little credence to the fact that we're not necessarily seeing that money. It's the money that's being sent out, it's the bill that's being sent to Medicare, and then they're giving a portion back. The argument I've always heard is, well, we need to increase our charges to Medicare so that we can actually get enough back to cover what it actually costs. So instead of like a normal business where it's, well, we're not going to pay for this. We don't have a choice to pay whether or not we're going to pay the federal government. We are kind of stuck there. So instead, we're just overbilling the federal government. And when it goes to having to charge somebody who is out of pocket, I mean, they're getting paid. How much does it cost, actually? Actually, I don't know. Just give them what we send Medicare. And it's way too much.
Yeah, I think that the Chargemaster is a list that's trying to cover the hospital's expenses. That's what my understanding is. It's an exhaustive list of every procedure, what it would cost to be in New York City versus Florida or Alabama to do that knee replacement. So it incorporates electricity costs, the actual site, every IV, every alcohol pad you use for something. It's an exhaustive list that they seem to change every couple months, that they can modify it as new things. So it's a living, breathing list. That, in my understanding, is it seems to be not the CFOs. They don't know. It seems to be an underling of the CFO, maybe a VP of finance or a VP of, I don't know, hospital accounting or something, that seems to make the definitions for this. And it's to make sure the hospital brings in enough revenue to cover the services they provide. That seems to be my summation of what a charge master is. But you're right. The gatekeeper has it, and we don't get to see it.
And to be clear, I'm not arguing, and I could argue, I'm just not arguing that the charge master that the prices need to be decreased. The hospital is well within their rights to charge whatever they think they need to cover their costs. I'm just arguing that we should know what that number is. And they would argue, well, it's a proprietary formula. I don't need the formula. I don't need to know how you came to that conclusion. I just need to know what it's going to cost my patients so that when they make a decision, and these decisions, you know, when I've talked about risk in the past, we don't talk about just the medical risk, but the risk to the patients financially. That factors into their decisions when we're talking about risk tolerance. And, you know, if they know that there's a 0.5% chance that I'm missing an epidural abscess and they really want to go for that MRI, well, let me tell you what that MRI costs. All of a sudden, they change their mind. Yeah,
we should know as physicians what the stuff that we want to do is costing patients, and patients should be able to shop around for their health care so that they can make an educated decision off of finances and not marketing.
Shared decision making ends when it comes to other people's pockets.
It's a terrible position to be in, to bankrupt somebody while trying to do good.
I've mentioned it before on this podcast that I used to keep track of the ECMO patients' bills, and the reimbursement for ECMO went down about 4 years ago, but it was roughly like $1 million for every 2 weeks. I mean, we could easily crush a family. But Allie, you brought up something about out-of-network billing and whatnot. There was this recent article in the New York Times about what it was specifically about MCARE, but I imagine it's all of these big delivery emergency medicine services like Team Health and whatnot. What they do, they take over a group. This is happening all over the country. And then what they found was like 100% of the time in MCARE's case, that led to surprise billing with out-of-network bills. What do those things mean?
So surprise billing is related to if a patient, even if they do their homework and they know what facilities they can go to, and if they have an emergency condition or they go to a facility that they want to get their care at, if the hospital brings in a specialist or a different provider that is not in their network, they will get a bill that's a surprise bill that is higher than they would have expected if they had, when they thought that they were all in network. So I think in emergency medicine, it's interesting because you have physician groups, you know, who contract with facilities, and the hospital may be in a patient's network, but each provider may not be, which is, I think, an amazing thing that happens, and totally unexpected, I think, from a patient standpoint, and a layperson who has no idea about the workings of contracts and physician groups. So in Arizona, this came up recently, actually, where we had a bill that came up.
Senate Bill 1441,
Thank you, Chris, about surprise billing. And actually, our residency and Maricopa's residency program was there on Doc Day last March. And it was this sort of same thing where one of the senators, I think it was Lesko.
Debbie Lesko.
Sponsored this bill because some of her constituents were complaining that they thought they were going to a facility in their network, and then they were getting bills from specialists and providers that were way more than they thought they were going to get paid. And they didn't have a way to work this problem out. And so I think the bill really addressed, and each state does it differently, but I believe our bill created sort of a mediation or arbitration process, a way to help patients negotiate their bills when they are way more than they thought they were going to be, and they're a surprise.
And this is a bipartisan effort. There are some Republicans that have been pushing against it. I think it's disingenuous that they're arguing that their reasoning for that is because it doesn't go far enough. I don't know if that's true, but it's passed in Texas, and they said that their arbitration has been able to resolve cases 94% of the time. It's been successful there. It's going on in Oregon, so I think it's a good thing.
One of the things that the New York Times article, one of the things it said was, you know, you have an emergency medicine job. You sign with a group, you become a partner of that group, you go to work. You have no idea. I have no clue what insurance companies I'm contracted with. I'm sure you guys don't either, right? But you just go to work. They send a bill, and you just assume that everything's been worked out on the administrative end. And the New York Times article implied that we were willingly doing this, and that's definitely not the case. I don't know anybody, any of my friends that have been working for a Democratic group that sells out to MCARE or any of those versions of MCARE that is happy with what happens to their salary and has no idea this stuff is going on.
So I get to talk to our medical students, our fourth years, about how to do your chart, because the emergency medicine chart is such a strange entity compared to all of the other notes that you do throughout medical school. So I tell them, look, your ED chart that you're going to do 25 to 30 to 40 times a shift is a historical document, a communication between providers, a legal document, and a bill of sale. And the bill of sale doesn't mean anything to you right now as a fourth year medical student, but it's going to mean the most to your boss. And it's the easiest to do. You just kind of check off some boxes, and that's about it. And it's not about bilking the patient or the healthcare system out of all of their money. It's about how to make sure you get paid for the stuff that you do that is so difficult in emergency medicine, having to deal with domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse, dead children, traumas. I mean, people who come in and they're intoxicated and they spit on you and stuff. I mean, it's a hard job of what we do. You work all the hours, all the weekends, all the holidays. So I think that, you know, having the MCARE article come out and say that emergency doctors are volitionally trying to take all this money irritates me.
It was implied.
Right. But there is a kernel of truth to that, of we are trying to work as hard as we can to have a good living. I mean, people don't go into medicine anymore trying to make it rich. That's long are the days gone where you're going to get a cruise to the Bahamas with Pfizer, you know. People aren't doing it to be rich anymore, but they are trying to just do what they're told to make sure that you keep a roof over your head and all that stuff, and to make a comfortable living after having done as much training as we've done. So I don't think we're implicit in it, but we are also, it's the only job where if you work harder, you're actually taking money away from people that are sick.
In the article, they talk about how MCARE takes these groups over and then immediately starts with these surprise bills because they're not contracted with any of the insurance companies, and the hospital encourages them to contract with the insurance providers they have, and that might take 2 years or something. But make no mistake, that's a money-making ploy, because if some of these companies are publicly traded companies, and you know, you're right, our hands are not clean in this either, because we try to document the best that we can, and the best that we can leads to more money, and we as a specialty have become well paid for that. And when we don't do those things, I remember when you came back from Texas, you talked about how when we were residents, we way over documented, and you would cut back your documentation. And I remember having this conversation with you saying, I don't even know how to do that. So I would just document everything, treating as if it was a full patient visit, and that leads to level 5 visits that probably are unnecessary. But if you choose not to do that, you might get punished, and that's a source of a class action lawsuit against MCARE, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm, it is.
So we've defined 5 topics so far. So we've talked about the exchange and the market, which is where our patients are going to find health insurance companies. And we've talked about how it's out there, but our patients aren't really all that informed about what they're looking for. They're probably looking at the bottom line. They're looking for the general.com, you know, that gives us the least amount of healthcare provision for the least amount of money, because they don't have a lot of money to spend on healthcare. But that is the market that we've created. We've talked about the charge master, which is how your hospital determines how much everything costs. We've talked about the secret druid society that oversees the charge master that you have to get into. It's a tattoo and a handshake. Is that right, Chris?
I think so.
Okay. We've talked about surprise billing, which is where a hospital brings in a specialist or some other provider that is not in your network and then bills the insurance company for that specialist. The insurance company just passes it along and says, well, they're not in my network. I guess they must have had a good reason. And then they pass it along to you. And so as a patient, you get billed for that. And the next one we were going to talk about was going to be balanced billing.
Yeah, so I come see you, Allie, and I get a bill. I get 2 bills. One of them is a bill from the hospital. Actually, let me word this a different way. I come see you, and I get something from my insurance company and a bill. And the insurance company document is an explanation of benefits that says, you know, you were charged X amount of money, and we pay 20% of that. And then I get a bill from you for the other 80%. Why is that the case? I pay for insurance so that I don't have to pay extra.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that the hospital or the physician is trying to get back all the money that wasn't paid by the insurance company, and that's balanced billing, right? So they're billing the patient and expecting the patient to cover whatever the remainder of that charge is.
But I thought the charge master was inflated to account for that very thing. How can that be the case?
The charge master was probably wrong in that particular instance, because the charge master applies to every patient that's presenting with that exact charge. But the insurance company is looking at that individual patient and saying, well, this is the plan they're on, and this is what we're willing to pay for. And that may be less than what the charge master wanted.
Right, but the charge master is inflated to account for the fact that they're not going to get everything they want on every patient. Right. So now you get a balanced bill to try to recoup the rest of that. We're going to steer away from Aaron's thing for a second. I want to know, what do you guys think? Is that okay? That's legal in every state, but I think 3. California and a couple others.
Not a big fan of it.
No, I'm not a fan of it either.
It only hurts the consumer, and we say consumer, we mean patient. So now we've turned, and that's the hard part with all of this, is we have turned medicine into a business. We have turned them into commodities. We are putting money at every level in our healthcare delivery, which is not ideal, right? None of us wanted to do that. None of us are trying to do that, but we are doing that.
Yeah, so I would say it's not okay for us either, because we didn't even know that was happening.
Guess who's the biggest culprit?
Us.
Emergency medicine, a health service research survey in 2011 found that 68% of all these involuntary contacts with providers that were out of network were emergency physicians. And those people are given those balanced bills. And we have nothing to do with it.
The interesting thing, and we're talking about out of network, in network, and we're talking, and I was completely ignorant on this. I thought, as an emergency service provider, I am not in anyone's network.
Right.
Nor need to be in a network.
Right.
You know, we cover everyone, because everyone should go to any ER that they're close to at that time. You know, it was weird. I had to, one time when I was in the Navy, and I was visiting here in Tucson as a resident trying to get a job, which worked. Woo! But I had, my son broke his clavicle. So I had to call the Navy and ask permission to go to a different ER. And that was the Navy. I was like, oh, that's the Navy. That's got to be crazy. But now, Like, do I need to tell my patients that you need to find out what ERs are in your network, and then how do they do them? Like, that just, it just asks this question. I'm just very upset that this exists.
Right, and even more complicated, an actual physical ER at a hospital may be in their network, but the providers within that ER may not be. And I don't know how you figure that out. Even the most savvy patient or consumer, I don't know how you figure that out.
Yeah, so one of the things that Obamacare did was set emergency medical services as one of the 10 essential health benefits, which we'll talk about. But I have two questions about that. One is, does that count just EMS? Or does that count what happens in the emergency department? And the second question is more of a question slash statement, and that doesn't really protect you from balance billing. All that says is the insurance company has to include that in their policy, but it doesn't protect you from balance billing.
It appears to protect most people from balance billing. And how many people have worked shifts where you have a patient who comes into the emergency department and this is their chief complaint? My orthopedist told me to come in and get admitted through the emergency department because that's the only way the insurance will be able to cover this elective surgery.
Right.
I've had that with ortho, I've had that with opto, I've had that with general surgery. And it seems silly that insurance companies would play that game where they'll pay these out. Maybe they're not paying much out. Maybe there is a degree of balance billing that still occurs there. But at least they're getting a larger portion than nothing that they would have, you know, had to pay all of it out of pocket.
I don't believe the insurance companies are playing the game. I feel the insurance companies have no choice in the matter. I feel like when you come through the,
I don't know,
because
those charges are a lot higher, and by the 80-20 rule, they're making more money.
So let's define the 80-20 rule real quick.
Yeah, I'll give you one of the stories from the book from Dr. Rosenthal. So she tells this story about this chemistry teacher in New York that gets Remicade infusions. $19,000 or something like that every 6 weeks for his Remicade infusion, and his
had
stuff,
to drop out and sell meth in order to continue.
So his rheumatologist moves to NYU Langone, and he wants to stay with his rheumatologist, so he gets his care there now too. And he goes and is met by this patient navigator at the front door that takes him by the arm and takes him to his very cool infusion suite that's got his private TV and Wi-Fi and snacks and all that stuff, and gets the same dose of Remicade that he always gets, and he looks at the bill for the insurance, it's $119,000. Same dose, same drug, and they're trying to figure out why. Well, in the 20s, when the blues started, it was like 95% of the money that they collected from premiums went to cover health care costs or recovered wages and those kinds of things.
Jared's on a first-name basis with Blue Cross and Blue Shield.
Who calls it the blues? Does anybody else call it the blues?
That's what they're called, the blues. That's a thing.
People that are paying their bills.
That's a good one.
So anyway, over time, as insurance became a bigger and bigger business and you could pay out CEOs bigger money and your operating costs became bigger, that 95 cents per dollar of premiums went down to like 60 cents. And so one of the things Obamacare did was it said you had to spend 80% of your money that you collect on premiums on either direct healthcare delivery or quality improvement. Well, if you're this conglomerate, if you're Anthem, which is now Blue Cross Blue Shield, if you're Anthem and you have this giant operating budget and a CEO that makes $100 million a year, you want to maintain that. So the only way that you can maintain that is to make your 20% much bigger. So you're okay with a $120,000 Remicade infusion.
So the entire industry gets inflated.
Right.
So that your 20% stays the same number, even though it's now 20%.
Right, and then we get blamed, just to wax philosophic for a minute, we get blamed for ordering Remicade because now we're driving up healthcare costs.
Right.
But the definition of the 80-20 rule is that the insurance company, the money that they make from premiums, is that 80% has to be used towards quality improvement, right? And
right.
And that's health benefits. But and then 20% is left is for overhead or
profit. It's
right.
For profit.
So all the stuff that we've talked about, all the stuff that we've talked about so far, has led to runaway costs, and we get blamed for costs a lot because one of the biggest chunks of the pie, I think it's like 20% of the pie or something, is physician salaries and how much we are reimbursed for what we do. And we are currently, I mentioned it earlier, we do something, that something has an RVU attached to it, that RVU has a dollar amount attached to it. This is something something I just figured out recently where, Chris, you and I might do the same exact thing that has the same exact RVU amount attached to it. We get reimbursed a certain amount differently because emergency medicine has a different work rate per RVU than critical care medicine. So if gastroenterology negotiates a better work rate per RVU here versus another hospital, that's how you get a procedure that costs far more here than in another hospital. So although it's meant to standardize things, it really doesn't standardize things, but that whole method of reimbursing what we do is called fee-for-service. And there's some people who want to move towards value-based purchasing where you get a lump of money for a certain procedure like a knee replacement or a hip replacement, and that lump of money is supposed to cover the procedure, the rehab, all the complications that would come for that. The question I have for you guys is, who determines what value means?
So the payer, who should or who does?
Who does, currently.
So who does is the person who pays the money. The insurance company who actually gives the money up. Remember, we talked about insurance is in the business of saying, no, you're not going to need this money. They want to determine what's of value to them. And so it's easy for them to say, your admission will cost you this much. And if the admission is complicated by a UTI, I'm not going to pay. If the admission is complicated by VRE or a CLABSI, we're not going to pay anything. That is a good patient care outcome. You should not get an indwelling Foley and get a UTI. You should not get a central line associated bacterial infection. These are bad things. It's to the insurance company's benefit if that happens, not that they want the patient to be ill or to have a bad outcome, but they're not going to pay. So that kind of value-based incentive, value-based pricing of saying, look, if you don't provide good care, we're not going to pay, I think that sounds great.
That is one opportunity that we have.
That screws us if we, you know, step in it and there's a mistake. I mean, sometimes this stuff happens. So the penalty for us making a medical mistake is we don't get paid. You know, is that right? Does that mean that everything that happened, you know, the emergency doctor put in a dirty line in a code and got the patient back and they developed a CLABSI? Does that mean that the nurse doesn't get paid, that the critical care doctor doesn't get paid, the surgeon doesn't get paid?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, and exactly. So is that part fair? Maybe not so much.
That is one of the things that we've become conscientious about because, you know, a patient comes in, let's say, to even take away blame, let's say I'm the ED physician, and the patient just hear me out. The patient
comes in. I can't even go there with you.
I intubate them, put in dirty lines, put in a Foley, all this other shit, right? And then I take them upstairs, and the next day I'm the ICU doctor. What am I going to do? I'm going to take out all those lines, I'm going to take out the Foley, I'm going to put in different lines and no Foley. So maybe that's one thing that we should do, because we're going to all bill for all those lines that we put in. So maybe we should put in clean lines, take the time to actually do that. Whether we have time or not, that's a different discussion. Or be more thoughtful about the lines that we put in and not reflexively put a Foley catheter in.
So this is where we get to the intention of a rule and then the unintended consequences of a rule. Because so what are the negative unintended consequences of a value-based payment system?
Well, you don't check things, right? So you say, we want our UTI rate down, so let's just not culture any urine.
You just won't check a urine. Yeah, you're not acting like you have a UTI. I'm not going to check.
You're sedated and paralyzed, but you don't
win. This started long before value-based, and we've been using DRGs for how long? Since the idea came up in the 70s. DRG is a diagnosis-related group. There's 467 groups, apparently, that a diagnosis can fall into, like an appendectomy is its own DRG, and you know, pneumonia is its own DRG. And the idea there was that you would come in for a pneumonia, and the CMS, so you asked before, who determines what you pay? I believe it's the government, right? CMS, Centers for Medicare, Medicaid Services.
Well, right. So that's the insurance company.
Of the insurance companies. They're the ones that determine the cost, right?
Right. And they started out, they created a lot of these, and then the insurance companies didn't want to create them themselves.
Correct.
And just took what Medicare, Medicaid had.
Correct. So if you're going to be given a lump sum to treat someone's pneumonia, and if you spend more than that lump sum taking care of that person's UTI that wasn't initially diagnosed, or they developed another complication, or whatever the problem is that arises, an arrhythmia or something that happens in their hospital stay, then you're going to eat up all those costs and then actually lose money if you spend more than the amount that you should receive. And conversely, you can make more money if you just get them out of the hospital faster.
Here's an example of that. Okay, so let's say you come in, I take care of you in the ICU, and you're pretty sick, and I keep you on the vent for 10 days, and I think, if I just work a little bit harder for 5 more days, maybe 10 more days, I can get you off the ventilator, right? And you get off the ventilator, and you do okay.
Better outcome for me.
Better outcome for you, right? But if I trach you, it's a higher DRG.
Yeah.
And I can get you out of the hospital faster. If I keep you and get you off the ventilator, my length of stay is higher. And by every metric of quality, I'm a terrible doctor. If I trach you, it's worse for you, but it's better for me and my metrics, and it's a higher DRG.
A higher DRG and a higher percentage of that DRG you get to keep. So that's an unintended consequence.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, and, you know, not that this would ever happen, but let's say somebody doesn't have adequate placement, you know, after their ED visit or their hospital stay. This is why it is cheaper to just keep the patient in the emergency department for days and days on end than to bring them into the hospital where there's nowhere to send them, because then this starts to add up and they've already been paid for the ED visit and, you know, whatever. It takes a couple extra shifts to get them out. We can deal with that.
Yeah, we didn't used to have these problems.
Mm-mm. So it's tough because you look at, like Jared said, you know, if I'm the ICU doctor or I'm the ER doctor and I can figure out what's going to be best for me, then that's a very microscopic view. But no one is able to really have the full macroscopic view of everyone's needs because you can't treat each patient as a lump sum.
I would rather not know these things.
Yeah. Every pneumonia is not going to be the same, and every appendectomy is not going to be the same, and every MI is not going to recover the same. So these are going to be different patients. So the issue with value-based pricing is if you say this is how much I'm going to pay you for it, then immediately everything comes down to your budget, and you go, well, we got to make budget, so where can we cut costs?
Right.
That's what every business does.
I hate this no margin, no mission saying, because it's like the excuse for doing evil. You know, oh, well, no margin, no mission.
Right.
That's not okay. And I would rather not know a lot of these things because when I go see my next patient tomorrow, I don't want it in the back of my mind.
Right. Why don't we just finish recording and then I'll just delete it and we'll pretend we don't know any of this stuff.
I want the red pill at the end of this.
Yeah, exactly. question is, should it? I mean, that begs the question, should this change your behavior as a practicing physician or as a advocate for healthcare or as a consumer of healthcare with your own family?
So then the last one is essential health benefits as defined by the ACA.
Yeah, so the intent behind the essential health benefits was to say, look, you if you're going to provide an insurance policy, it has to be a meaningful policy. You can't strip out the things that people are likely to need, which is like mental health, emergency medical services, maternity care,
pediatrics.
So the list of 10 categories for essential health benefits are ambulatory patient services, emergency services, hospitalization, pregnancy, maternity and newborn care, mental health and substance use disorder services, prescription drugs, rehabilitative and habilitative services and devices, laboratory services, preventive and wellness services, and pediatrics. Those are really broad categories.
But it makes sense. I mean, what's the point of paying $700 a month for an insurance policy if you need it, you can't use it?
Right. Well, imagine if you were looking at an insurance policy, would you take one that only had maybe like two of these? Yeah. We're going to do outpatient care and emergency services. The rest of it, you know, it's up to you. Figure it out. Oh, you got to get another policy.
We're going to do mental health and dental.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest. I probably wouldn't. I'm a grown man. I'm a physician. I have a family. I wouldn't know to look for these things if I was shopping around for an insurance policy. I'll just be honest. I'd be like, oh, that one looks good.
So we had our insurance switch as our provider group a few years ago, and I think Allie put together a giant spreadsheet of all of the different options between these. All right, maybe it wasn't Allie, but I'll give her credit. And it was staggering trying to figure out what the different difference was between the plans we were offered, and we're actually offered a choice. A lot of people just say, this is what you get with your job, go. You know, and with the insurance, there's, you know, the insurance companies love the idea of the high deductible plan as well.
That's the reboot of the catastrophic plan.
Right. And for many of us, that's fine. For me, that's probably fine. You know, I'd rather take my premium and save it and then spend it on what I want. But I'll tell you that personally, we had to go through a lot of different tests for something recently, and I did not know how much anything was going to cost. I knew exactly what was going to happen. We're going to get blood work, we're going to get an ultrasound, and then we're going to get an MRI, and then we're going to get a scope. And if all those things are normal, then everything that I'm truly worried about is off my mind, and I don't care how much it costs because it's for a family member. And that's where the business of medicine just really eats at your soul, you know? It's not like, well, I want to get a car, and I really want all these options, but, you know, if I don't get them all, I just need something that runs. You don't do that for a loved one. You do everything you possibly can, and you're willing to bankrupt yourself for something like this. So the fact that we don't even know that we're bankrupting our patients really makes me feel terrible.
So if you make a good living, you could a $10,000 hit's painful, but it's not going to bankrupt you. If you make $40,000 a year, that's a fourth of your income. It's going to bankrupt you, right? But that was the catastrophic plan.
Right. And so, like, you know, there's arguments about having, you know, putting people that are on Medicare and Medicaid, of giving them a health care savings account, but they don't make the money to actually put it in there. You could have it directly go to their account and, you know, only have it used for certain services. There's arguments about whether primary care should be covered at all. Preventative care, if it's just something you should, you know, expect to pay for, you just put it as a line in your budget. And many people in the U.S. don't do a budget or think in that way. So, I mean, in the emergency department, we know people don't plan for stuff. So we're ready for all the stuff people aren't ready for. So it's very difficult with some of these essential health benefits to get everyone in a room and agree what should be an essential health benefit.
It was one of the points of contention with the Republican House plan, or with the House of Representatives plan, was the essential health benefit.
Although, I mean, as a layperson, it's confusing. You say something's an essential health benefit, yet half the stuff that you thought is supposed to be covered all of a sudden isn't covered anymore. And so I feel like it's kind of an oxymoron. I mean, or at least it's a very confusing picture to a consumer.
Knowing this information, should we or will we change our own practices with our patients?
Okay, so I'll go first. So I think the charge master drives me absolutely crazy. It has always driven me crazy that I don't know how much these tests are, and that I can't say with a straight face, trust me, this is going to be the best thing. Most of the time, if somebody is critical, I'll say, do you want me to do everything? Yes, do everything. And I feel perfectly justified with every test that I've done in trying to resuscitate somebody. It's the patients that are the, you know, walking wounded or the worried well that really want a chest x-ray. Fine, do a chest x-ray. It's easier for me to get you in and out. I want a Z-Pak. Let's give them a Z-Pak because it's easier to get them in and out. If I could say, sure, I'll give you your chest x-ray, but just to let you know, with your insurance, that's going to cost you $450. I'll do it. I'll be happy to do it, but I don't think you need it, and it's expensive. Versus if I tried to say that now, I would have nothing to be able to say. So it would be nice to know anyone's charge master, even if it's not ours, to have some idea. You know, I don't know how much it costs here, but I can tell you that if we were in Gainesville, Florida, it would cost you this much.
A ballpark with a confidence in it.
Yeah, something, you know. It would be nice to have some list. When I worked at one of the low-cost clinics in town, they had a list that they had worked out with one of the labs and one of the imaging places in town because they were low cost and they tried to negotiate for the patients and they were dirt cheap. I'm talking $9 for a CBC, $25 for an x-ray. Dirt cheap. I guarantee you we don't charge that.
That's free market. really, if we consider ourselves professionals, and what is a professional? It's a self-governing body. Okay, it's not somebody who relies on other people to tell them how to govern themselves. It's a self-governing body. If we think we're professionals, when we approach patient care, there shouldn't be a difference as to whether it's value-based payment or fee-for-service. We should practice the same care. Now, having said that, everyone falls into a continuum of how paternalistic they're willing to be medically, and I would argue some of us are a little more paternalistic, and some of us really, really rely heavily on like shared decision making. Do we do that also with finances? I think we would if we knew the data. But I've had many, many encounters with patients where I say, well, I'll talk to them about what I think the probability of them having a head bleed is versus the clinical concussion that I think they just have. And I'll talk about doing a head CT, and then I'll ask them, are you paying for this out of pocket, or is someone else paying for it? And if they say they have insurance, I say, do you know what your deductible is? And if they know and it's normal, it's appropriate, then we talk about the pros and cons. And it's just, from then on, it's a purely medical discussion as to whether they need a head CT. Same thing with a PE study. If I really think they're pretty low risk, but not low risk enough that I can use our clinical decision rules, I talk about doing a PE study. You know, we do that with TPA all the time. So are we educated enough to have a financial discussion and talk about our degree of paternalism or shared decision making? I don't think I'm educated enough to have that discussion. I try to steer people. I can basically say it's going to cost you a ton of money, or it's going to be, you know, well covered. That's as far as I can go. I would love to have more detail with it.
I'm not the most test ordering fool, but I do give a whole lot of meds, so I'm more of the treater than the diagnoser or tester. So, you know, with this, you know, I kind of reflect on it myself. Do I need to go to Costco and buy a jar of Tylenol and Motrin and just hand it out to patients as they come in? Would that save them the charge master, you know, $5 a pill, because it's something and I can alleviate some suffering, but it's probably the right thing to do? Maybe I'll get in trouble with the hospital if I do that. If it just say, oh, this was your own Tylenol, it looks like you can take your own medicines, go ahead and take that. Probably, if I was really ballsy, that would be the right thing to do. That's probably the best thing.
Or draw your own blood.
Or draw my own blood. You know,
but not using an IV, because there's a charge for the stroke,
blood draw fee, yeah.
There's a charge for the blood draw, and a charge for the insertion of the catheter.
Well, that's why I would get a mosquito. But
no, you would train a mosquito.
I would train a mosquito and then milk the mosquito, because you can milk just about anything. So, but if, you know, that said, is it going to change my practice on most patients? Probably not for 80 to 90%, but I think there's a margin I can improve on. In knowing some of this, and maybe it's cutting down some of those unnecessary tests. Maybe it's trying to have that paternalistic or shared decision-making conversation with the patient who you know can't afford something. You know, and it's not to say to judge, but you know patients, well, you know, and I don't ask them insurance, but you know people who have insurance and don't have insurance. But at the same time, still doing right by the patient, maybe doing less is more right. And I think that's what I want to try to improve on. I don't like the fact that, you know, I felt dirty. I think I may have shared this story before, but I felt dirty with some of my patients. I mean, now I have billing people come in. I had a guy who had a tiny cut on his thumb, and billing came in, and before I had even made a decision on what I was going to do for this thumb, which in the back of my head was, let's put some glue or just a Band-Aid and send you home. And they said, that'll be $725.
Oh my gosh.
And asked for his credit card right in front of me. Now, I did not sleep well that night. I showered three times with a Hibiclens, and I still felt dirty. Okay? Jeez. So at that point, what did I do? Because I'm a dirty physician, I said, let's do a digital block and sutured, and threw three sutures in it, just to make him feel like he got money out of it.
His $700 worth.
Something that he couldn't do by himself.
Right, that he couldn't do by himself to get the $700. Now the question is, I was probably an out-of-network provider. They balance billed for the extra procedures, and I double screwed them, and I feel like a total asshole now. I'd say that. Oh. Anyway, so, but I feel really bad about that. But then what's the right thing? You know, I feel dirty either way. I think this has to change my practice to some degree, because otherwise I'm putting my head in the sand with knowledge that I shouldn't have or should have. But I think we should have this, like Chris said, and Aaron said, you've got to get that charge master list.
I think that at least all of us here, for the most part, everybody that we work with and that we know and trained, tries to do the right thing, and the right thing that we learned medically to do for patients. And we're all fallible humans, and maybe we should take a step back and consider. I know I work in the most expensive place in the hospital, so maybe instead of saying, they're not waking up as quickly as I want to, I'm gonna go get a CT, and that didn't tell me what I want, and I'm gonna get an MRI and all that. Maybe I'll just be like, I'll wait another day or something, you know? But for me, I think the value of this information is we are the professionals. We have to know what's going on our behalf. Because when you get sick, you go see your doctor. You don't go see your hospital. And if the apocalypse happened and wiped out all of the doctors, there would be no medicine. But if some IT electromagnetic bomb went off and wiped out all the hospitals, we could still practice medicine. It would be wilderness medicine, but we would still be the physicians that practice medicine and rebuild it in our names. And we might disagree on what that would look like, but we need to know where we come from, what the problems have been, what the current issues are, and how we can have an active role in shaping the future.
I think I just heard all the nurses in 37 countries roll their eyes collectively.
Well, not South Dakota, so maybe not saying that.